Today is June 7th, 2014. Okay, good morning, everybody. Okay, we will start with the homage to the Buddha. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Okay, so today we are continuing with the sutta that we started last week. This is sutta number 115 in the Middle Length Discourses. It's called in Pali the Bahu Dhatuka Sutta, which means the discourse on many kinds of elements. Okay, just to sort of recapitulate, the Buddha begins the discourse by highlighting the difference between the foolish person who is the cause of much trouble and misery for himself and others, and the wise person who never causes trouble or difficulties for himself or others. Then he urges the monks to be wise people, to be inquirers. Then Ananda asks him, how can a monk be called a wise man and an inquirer? Then the Buddha says that he should be skilled in the elements, skilled in the bases, skilled in dependent origination, and skilled in what is possible and what is impossible. So these are like the main headings of the discourse, the main topics that he'll cover. And now, since the Buddha mentioned the elements first, he explains different types of elements, different groups of elements. So in section 4, he starts off with the 18 elements. Those are the 6 sense base, 6 sense objects, 6 sense faculties, and 6 types of consciousness. And then he goes into another set of elements. These are the 6 elements, the 5 material elements, earth, water, fire, air, space, and consciousness. And then he goes into the 3rd category of elements are the 6 types, which are actually 6 elements, which are actually 5 elements or types of feelings: pleasure, joy, pain, sorrow, equanimity, and ignorance. That is what we covered last week. So now we come to section number 7, where Ananda asked the Buddha whether a monk can be called skilled in the elements in some other way. And then the Buddha mentions that there is such another way, and he enumerates another set of 6 elements. These are called, if you look in the text, the sensual desire element, the renunciation element, the ill will element. Then here we translate it very literally, the non-ill will element, but let's be a little less literal. We'll call it the goodwill element. So ill will versus goodwill. Then the cruelty element, which is contrasted with the non-cruelty element. Again, let's be a little less literal, and we'll translate this as the compassion element. And so these elements, now, if you're familiar with some of the other ways in which the Buddha expounds the discourse, expounds his teaching, does this remind you of any other set of categories or any other analysis that you've come across previously? Osmond?
It sounds like a long view, wide view.
Very close, not exactly.
For the,
just go one step further.
And then the intention?
Right, exactly. These are correspond exactly to the wrong intention and right intention in the Noble Eightfold Path. So in the Noble Eightfold Path, we have the eight factors, right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, right concentration. So if we just focus in on the second factor of the path, I think we could find it in Sutta 141. Well, in 141, it's actually done expounding only the right intention, but we find it on page 1100. Here we have right intention, the intention of renunciation, intention of non-ill will or goodwill, intention of non-cruelty or compassion. And we also find it, I think, this contrast in the sutta that we'll be taking next week. Exactly, on page 935. In section 11, we have what is wrong intention? The intention of sensual desire, the intention of ill will, and the intention of cruelty, that is wrong intention. And then in paragraph or section 13 on page 935, starting at the very end, actually going over really to page 936, we have the intention of renunciation, the intention of goodwill or non-ill will, and the intention of non-cruelty or compassion. And so here in this discourse on elements, these types of thoughts, for some reason they're referred to as elements. It's a rather unusual designation for them. But we could more conveniently think of them as different types of thoughts. And these two types of thoughts fall into three groups which are opposed to each other. There is the intention of sensual desire, or thoughts of sensual desire, and then that is counteracted by the thought or the intention of renunciation, of giving up the objects of sensual desire. Then there is the thoughts of ill will, anger, resentment, hatred, antagonism, and so forth. And those are overcome by the intention of goodwill, which becomes most manifest in the development of what's called metta, maitri, loving kindness, the wish for the welfare and happiness of others. And then there is the intention of cruelty, which is expressed in the wish to inflict harm and suffering on others. And then that's overcome by the intention of non-cruelty or compassion, the feeling of empathy for those who are afflicted with suffering and manifesting in the wish to relieve the pain, misery, and suffering of others. Okay, so this is a fairly basic It's a bit puzzling that they're called elements, but once you understand that here what's being pointed to by the word elements are these thoughts or intentions, then the meaning becomes quite self-evident. Okay, we can move on now to the next section. I'll take the next two sections, then I'll ask whether there's any questions. Okay, so after the Buddha gives this explanation, then Venerable Ananda asks whether there's another type of elements in which a monk can be skilled. And the Buddha says that there is. And then he explains that there are these three elements: the sense sphere element, the fine material element, and the immaterial element. And here it seems to me that this word dhatu in Pali can be translated in two different ways in English, whereas for some reason in Pali the two meanings overlap. So far we've been translating this word dhatu as element. But in this context, in this passage, it seems dhatu is best rendered as realm, R-E-A-L-M. So these are the three realms of existence. We always have to be mindful that I'm a dog tied to a post. But unlike a dog, I can take my post along. Okay, so these are the different spheres or realms of rebirth, the different planes into which beings can be reborn in what we call samsara, the cycle of birth and death. So this is the totality of samsara, and then it's divided into these three basic spheres or three realms. So we have the sense sphere, which is the sphere or realm in which experience through the senses is most prominent, and in which sensual desire is the main driving force of living beings. And so sometimes the sense sphere is also called the desire realm. And this includes five planes of existence, starting from the bottom. There's the hell realms, Then there's the animal realm, then the realm of the afflicted spirits or hungry ghosts, then the human plane of existence, and then there's a number of heavenly realms, sensual heavenly realms. And then there is above the sense, you say, in the sense or form, in the sense sphere, sensual desire is the driving force. But if a human being develops the mind to the deep levels of samadhi, concentration, what they call the meditative absorptions, then the mind, even in the human world, goes beyond the grip, the force of sensual desire, and experiences certain very elevated planes of experience in which the mind is unified, concentrated, filled with bliss, joy, peace, tranquility. And now those states of consciousness generate a particular powerful karmic force. And so when death comes, the karmic power of developing those states of consciousness as a human being, that karmic power will propel consciousness beyond the sense sphere to one of the planes in the form sphere or the fine material sphere, so that the being, the person, will be reborn in one of these very elevated realms in which they still have a physical body, but it's a very subtle kind of body, and they don't experience the grosser types of sense experience. But they'll still have some consciousness of forms and sounds, and they'll spend most of their time in meditative absorption. So these are really, like, to call them divine planes of existence. And there are approximately, actually, I think it's probably closer to 15. I didn't do an exact count. But there are a number of planes within this realm of existence which are graded according to the level of samadhi, the level of concentration. And then, again, this is for a human being, by developing samadhi meditation even further, by strengthening the power of concentration, it's possible to go beyond even the levels of concentration that lead to the form sphere and to attain certain formless types of concentration. We meet these in the texts under the names the sphere of boundless space, the sphere of boundless consciousness, the sphere of no-thingness, and the sphere of neither perception nor non-perception. So one who attains these states as a human being, these meditative absorptions, by the power of that samadhi, assuming that they are able to maintain these states of concentration through the rest of their life, that power of concentration generates a karma that propels the consciousness at death to rebirth in the formless sphere. In the formless sphere, or immaterial sphere, there's no physical body. The being is just pure consciousness, so to speak. Consciousness together with mental functions. Again, don't ask me what it's like in the questions section. Whether they sell ice cream there, I doubt it. So if you like, is it Baskin Robbins that has 31 flavors? You have to get back into the sense sphere. And if you want to go to nirvana also, you should avoid the formless sphere. Because in the formless sphere, you don't have the ability to cultivate wisdom to the highest level. because it's so peaceful, so tranquil, that one just remains in the state of utter tranquility and can't develop insight or wisdom. And now what's important to understand is that all three of these spheres, as I said, they belong to samsara. This is not liberation, not nirvana, not complete release. And so the ideal, the ultimate goal for the Buddha's teaching is to break out from the three realms of existence, to reach that completely transcendent state. So, if one develops the power of samadhi, of concentration, one can be reborn in the form sphere, live there for many hundreds and thousands of years, but eventually that comes to an end and one can be reborn elsewhere. One can develop the power of concentration, one gets reborn in the formless sphere, and one lives there for 20,000, sometimes they say 20,000 aeons, really long period. And so one is, you know, without a body, but one is sitting there, in a sense, absorbed in this perfect bliss and tranquility. Then 10,000 aeons pass, 15,000, 18,000, 19,000 aeons. And now the sort of the ticker, you know, the clock, like on the scoreboard, you know, on the baseball, the football games, it's going down, down, down until it gets to, you know, 24 hours, 12 hours, 6 hours, 3 hours, 1 hour, 59 minutes, 10 minutes, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 1 minute, then the second ticker starts, 60 seconds, 30 seconds, 20 seconds, 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, bing. What's going on? Whoops. Where am I? Then 9 months later, wah, wah. Mommy, mommy. Then 5 years later, Tommy, come, we're going to kindergarten. Then high school. Then have to apply for college admission. Then graduation day. Then have to search for a job all over again. Okay, so the aim is not to be reborn in one of these higher spheres, but liberation. Okay, so these are the three realms that's mentioned here, the three types of elements, which we also call realms. And then Ananda asks whether there's another way in which a monk can be called skilled in the elements. And then the Buddha says that there could be, and then he mentions that there are these two elements, the conditioned element and the unconditioned element. And these two can be understood in terms of this diagram that I've put on the board right here. So everything that comes within the three realms this marker is falling from the form realm down into the garbage bin. I'm going to recycle it. So all of these belong to the conditioned element. And what is meant by conditioned? Conditioned is anything that arises from causes and conditions. So according to the Buddha's teaching, everything within our ordinary experience arises from causes and conditions. Not only everything that arises within our experience, but we ourselves, the experiencer, arise from causes and conditions. So the body comes from causes and conditions. It came from, at the most basic level, or the original level, the union of the sperm with the egg. Then it was nurtured by nutrition, and now we exist. The body exists dependent upon food, air, water, particular type of climate. A whole bundle of conditions support the body. And all of the mental experience depends upon conditions, upon objects, sense faculties, and so forth. So everything within experience, normal experience, is conditioned. But beyond the normal experience, there's one thing which is unconditioned, and that is nirvana. This is a dimension, a reality, a sphere, you can use various other words, which does not arise through causes and conditions. So it's ever existent. It's described by the Buddha as unproduced, without any becoming or change, without any origination, and without any perishing or passing away. So it's called also the deathless. Okay, now that we've gone through these three sections on the elements, now I'll ask whether there's any questions.
How does karma play into all of this?
Okay, karma, you mean into this scheme of the elements?
This construct of causes and conditions.
Mind. Yeah, well, karma is one of the primary causes and conditions. So karma is... What is karma? What they call karma? Karma is actually volitional action which is motivated or driven by intention, by purpose. And so the intentions, or intentional actions, create this force called karma. And then karma is what, at the initial level, it's what brings rebirth into one of the spheres of existence. And then other accumulated karmas in the course of life, other karmas that have been accumulated will then bring results, particular results in the course of life. And as we go on in this sutta, we'll see that there's analysis or distinctions made in the different types of karma.
Thank you.
Yes, please. We have this mobile microphone.
Regarding the formless sphere, we have those are the three stages or realms you're referring to.
Yeah.
How do you get, when you're down in the formless sphere, because you're deep in meditation, really just consciousness, how do you get from there to nirvana? And you mentioned that you could be reborn again.
Yeah.
But how do you
in
get
the form in the formless sphere, unless one has already reached the first stage of awakening, of enlightenment, the stage of stream entry or higher, in the formless sphere, one can't go directly to nirvana.
They can't.
Because in the formless sphere, one doesn't have a body, and in order to acquire the right understanding of the Dharma, one has to learn it, one has to hear it.
So in reality, the only form would be the sense sphere that can go up to nirvana, because even the formless sphere.
I believe in the form sphere, the beings in the form sphere can go to nirvana because they have physical bodies. And, I mean, this is said in the text. I leave it to people whether to believe or not. But when the Buddha is giving discourses, the beings from the form sphere, invisible to human beings, but they can be around listening to the Buddha or some of the great, you know, the great masters teach the Dharma. And so they're able to hear it and to reflect on it and contemplate it. And so they could reach the stages of awakening within the form sphere.
But the most powerful one to be able to get directly to nirvana is in the sense sphere.
They say that the sense sphere provides like the strongest conditions, because in order to reach even the first stage of awakening, one has to have some understanding of the extent of suffering, of dukkha. And it's in the human realm that we have the balance of suffering and happiness. We can see how they alternate, and we get a clearer perception of impermanence. So that's possible within the human realm.
What about the animal realm?
No. The three lower realms, it's not possible, because the extent of misery in those realms is too heavy. So they're not able to they're obsessed with the idea, especially like the hell realms, the realm of the hungry ghosts, the tormented spirits. There's too much pain and misery, and so they're just concerned with getting out of their misery.
So by getting out of the misery, they actually then kind of like purifying down there before they get to the point where they can come back as a sense sphere, then be able to get to nirvana?
Well, they're sort of experiencing the results of their karma in those realms. And then when they finish, when they exhaust that karma, then they can come back into the human realm. And then within the human realm, if they have good supporting conditions, then they can meet the teaching and then make some progress on the way to nirvana. But it's always said that the human realm, and then above the human realm, there are some heavenly realms in which there's sensual experience, that these realms are more favorable than, let's say that the human realm is said to be the most favorable. In the heavenly realms, often those beings get swept away by their attachment to their intense sensual pleasures. Johnny.
Bande, is there any volition formation in the formless sphere?
Yeah. When they go into these states of deep meditation, they're creating volitional formations in that state. And also they come out from that deep meditation and then they have volitional activities there. Of course, I don't know what they're like because that's beyond my own personal experience, but this is what is said in the text. Sandy.
The sutras emphasize the word cease here. Can you explain a little bit more detail about this word cease? Cease the element. What does it mean by cease the element?
Knows and sees. This is a mental understanding. Doesn't mean visually seeing, but it means sort of seeing with the eye of wisdom or understanding them. And it doesn't mean, I don't think it means that every practitioner has to be able to have a direct, supernormal, direct visual experience of the beings in the form realm or the formless realm. But I think it just means to understand them more than intellectually, but to understand them with the eye of wisdom. That's the way I would understand it.
What's the reference material to get the details, like for all the spheres, 15 planes, or 14? Is there one book or distributed over 20 volumes?
In the suttas, I don't think that they're collected into one sutta, but it's sort of, you know, mentioned here, there, distributed over the four Nikayas. There is a book, it's in the Abhidharma Bitaka, which sort of collects all of this together. It's the book of the Abhidharma Bitaka. The Pali name is Vibhanga, but it's translated under the title The Book of Analysis. And it's published by the Pali Text Society. And it's the last chapter of that book. I think it's chapter 16. It's called The Heart of the Doctrine, The Heart of the Dharma. That has a very, it goes into a lot of detail using Abhidharma classifications, but it brings together all of this. And then I think also you find it in the comprehensive manual of Abhidharma, which I had put together, and then we've been using that book for our Abhidharma seminar, a comprehensive manual of Abhidharma in chapter 5. And it has everything in a diagram. You get it all in two, it's a two-page diagram. Okay, let's go on because I want to finish the sutta today. Okay, now Ananda has finished asking about elements, so now he asks whether a monk can be called skilled in the bases. Here the term for bases is Okay, so these are the six bases for conscious experience. And we have six internal bases, which are the six faculties, six sense faculties: eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, and the mind faculty. And then six external bases, which are their objective realms: visible forms, sounds, smells, tastes, tactile objects, objects of touch, and mental objects, or mental phenomena, dharmas. And so these actually were pretty much we already covered under the elements. For some reason, the Buddha takes them out from the 18 elements and has a separate set of categories called the 12 bases. Okay, then we'll move on to the next set. The next topic, because the Buddha said that the monk should be skilled in dependent origination. So now Ananda asks, how can a monk be called skilled in dependent origination? And this is a very key doctrine in the Buddhist teaching. This is called in Pali it's called Paticca Samuppada. So the word paticca means dependent upon, and samuppada means origination. Arising, but it suggests a complex process of arising. And so it's in some of the suttas we see that the Buddha describes this as the particular object of his realization on the night of his enlightenment. It was the discovery of dependent origination that brought his enlightenment, his awakening. And dependent origination is both a kind of abstract principle, and then there's a way of exemplifying, a common exemplification of that principle. We find here in the sutta, we see the abstract principle. The Buddha first states the abstract principle. He says, a bhikkhu knows thus, when this exists, that comes to be. With the arising of this, that arises. When this does not exist, that does not come to be. With the cessation of this, that ceases. So the dependent origination means that any phenomenon, anything that exists, comes to be in dependence upon certain conditions. For something we call this Y to arise, something else, its condition, X has to arise. If Y depends upon X and X hasn't arisen, Y can't arise. It's only when X has arisen that Y can arise. And when X ceases, if Y depends upon X, when X ceases, Y ceases. And so that is the abstract principle. But the Buddha wasn't, you know, he wasn't an abstract philosopher interested in just, you know, finding general principles. But his teaching was intended to solve the problem of birth and death, you know, to gain liberation from the cycle of birth and death. So when he was investigating in the course of his enlightenment, he went back and inquired, why is there old age, suffering, and death? And then when he inquired, he saw that old age and death depends on birth. So if one isn't born, then there's no growing old, falling sick, and dying. Then he inquired, why is there birth? What is the condition for birth? The condition for birth is called in the text bhava, here translated being or existence. And what this means is that in the previous life there was some propensity for taking a new existence. That there was a kind of force built up, this would be the force of karmic accumulations built up, that was directing consciousness towards a new birth in one of the three realms of existence. Then he inquired, why is there this propensity for new existence? Yeah, I think I know the source of the problem. I was getting the mic part caught under the...
No battery.
No, it's not the... There's no problem with the battery here.
Oh.
It's not the battery. This thing was getting caught under my robe. I just have to keep it out. Okay, so why is there this propensity for new existence? Why is the stream of consciousness moving towards the new birth in one of the realms of existence? It's because of clinging, especially clinging to the notions of I and mine. Then why is there this clinging? He traces it back because of craving. Why is there craving? Because of feeling. Why is there feeling because of contact through the senses? Why is there contact through the senses? Because there are the six sense bases. Why are there the six sense bases? Because this complex of body and mind, with body and mental factors, has come into existence. Why? What does this complex of body and mental factors depend on? It all depends on consciousness coming into a new existence. Because consciousness is the kind of, call it the channel that maintains continuity from life to life. Why has consciousness come into a new existence? Because of the volitional formations, the volitional activities, the various activities that have created karma. And why do we engage in these volitional activities, particularly those rooted in the mental defilements? That is because of ignorance. So that's a very concise explanation of dependent origination. Since we have a lot of topics in the sutta, I don't want to give a detailed account of dependent origination here. I've already done it in relation to several other suttas. So this is just a general overview, a quick overview of dependent origination. Okay, so then that is the side of origination, but then there's the side of cessation. And so to end old age, sickness, and death, one has to stop the process of birth. To stop the process of birth, one has to basically, to put it very concisely, one has to put an end to clinging, craving, and ignorance. Those are the driving forces that underlie the round of rebirths. I'm not sure whether I should ask for questions about dependent origination here, because as I said, I'm just treating it very concisely. Look.
I do just the word, what is the relationship between the word nidana. Is it the same word?
Nidana is sometimes used for each of the factors of dependent origination. So, say, birth is a nidana, existence is a nidana, clinging is a nidana, craving is a nidana. Each of those is a nidana. You can say a cause. But sometimes nidana is used in a general sense for the whole process of dependent origination. Okay, now I want to go on to the next section, which is that called the possible and impossible. Okay, and now the Buddha is going to develop this topic by explaining certain things that are possible, certain things that are impossible, in contrasting pairs. Okay, so he begins with certain things that's impossible for a person who possesses right view. And this is referring to a person who has the world-transcending right view. This is the not just a right understanding of the Dharma, but who has actually seen the truth of the Dharma through direct experience. A person who has made the breakthrough to realization. It's not necessarily the person, the arahant, the one who has reached the end of the path, but this is the person who has entered upon the irreversible path. A person who has entered into the stream and can never go back to the level of a worldly person. So such a person could never treat, or better to render, regard any formation, any conditioned thing as permanent. That is impossible. But it's possible for an ordinary person to regard things as permanent. Again, it's impossible for a person who has right view to regard any conditioned phenomena as sukha here, as pleasurable. This has to be understood in a special sense. Like a person with right view, even an arahant could regard ice cream, for example, as pleasurable. And he'll regard like these Ayurvedic medical preparations, we call them decoctions, as unpleasant, they're bitter. Or even bitter gourd, a popular dish in South Asia, he'll regard it as bitter. It doesn't mean that the person loses their experience of pleasure and pain as sensations, but what's meant that he doesn't regard any conditioned phenomena as being a basis for some kind of secure, everlasting happiness. So he doesn't rely on conditioned phenomena. And then the third type of impossibility here is that such a person with right view will not regard any phenomena as being his self or herself, as being a truly existent self. So they look upon the five aggregates as being just this collection of aggregates, but they understand these five aggregates, body, feeling, perception, mental activities, consciousness, as being not mine, not I, not myself. Even a person at the lower stages of enlightenment will still have some intrinsic clinging to the five aggregates. So sometimes they'll think, they'll act as if they're taking the aggregates to be mine and I. They could have some pride. Sometimes they'll can be a little conceited and look down at others. They might have a little craving left for possessions. But when they step back and reflect, then they realize that all of these things are really unrelated to a self, not related to a self. And so they can easily become detached from them. Okay, then we come to the next set of six things which are said to be impossible for a person with right view, who has this world-transcending, this liberating right view. It's impossible that such a person could deprive his mother of life and his father of life. But it said it's possible for an ordinary person, one who doesn't have this level of enlightenment, to take the life of his mother or father. And, you know, it seems that this is quite a remarkable statement, because even all of us, you know, we would never think of harming our mother or father, but until one reaches that first stage of enlightenment, there is always that possibility, that potential in the mind. And sometimes you read in the newspaper, somebody who has been brought up apparently in a harmonious and happy family, but he just gets sort of misdirected at some point, and he kills his parents. Or maybe there's some built-up bitterness from childhood which just explodes. But this is impossible for a person with right view. And it's impossible, continuing, for a person with this right view to take the life of an arahant. And then it's impossible for a person of this right view to maliciously injure the Buddha, causing him to shed blood. I think this was said because Devadatta, who was the Buddha's cousin and very envious of the Buddha, and he wanted to kill the Buddha and to take over the leadership of the Sangha. And so one day, when the Buddha was outside walking, doing walking meditation outside a cave, Devadatta went up to the top of the hill and he pushed a boulder so that it came rolling down the hill towards the Buddha. His intention was to kill the Buddha, that the boulder would hit the Buddha, knock the Buddha off the hill and kill him. But the boulder sort of got deflected off another rock and went in a different direction. But when it hit the other rock, then a splint of stone got knocked off the boulder and hit the Buddha in the leg and caused him to bleed. And so Devadatta committed that terrible deed. Okay, so that's the fourth one. The fifth one is that it's impossible for a person of right view to cause, maliciously to cause, a schism in the Sangha. That is, when the Sangha or community is in harmony, if somebody plots and schemes with bad intentions to create a division in the order, the monastic order, that becomes a terrible, heavy karma. And then it's the sixth one in the set, is that it's impossible for a person with this right view to acknowledge somebody else apart from the Buddha as his spiritual teacher or master. I mean, this doesn't mean that somebody with right view, of course, maybe he'll be a disciple of this Achan, this Soyador, this Bhante, but that doesn't contradict this statement. What is meant is that somebody who has this direct experiential right view of the Dhamma won't look to anybody else as the supreme spiritual teacher, anybody else but the Buddha, because he knows that the Buddha is the one who has seen the ultimate truth. And so he will regard the Buddha as his, you know, supreme guide on the path to enlightenment. Okay, maybe at this point I'll ask whether there's any questions before we get into some of the more controversial areas. So you go on then. Okay. So now, next one, he says, it's impossible, it cannot happen, that two, let's just leave the terminology here, we'll say two fully enlightened Buddhas can arise at the same time in one world system, or in one world. And what this means is that when a Buddha arises, then appears in the world, then he gives his teaching to the world, and then the teaching will last a certain number of years. In the case of Gautama Buddha, they say his teaching is supposed to last 5,000 years. So that is the lifespan of the Dharma. Now, within this period, it said, it's impossible for another Buddha to arise that is a fully enlightened Buddha, one who has, you know, fully mastered the Dharma and could teach it in its completeness. It doesn't mean that it's impossible for other beings or people to achieve enlightenment during the time of the Buddha's teaching. I mean, the purpose of the Buddha's teaching is to enlighten people, but they become enlightened through the teaching, the guidance, the instructions of the Buddha, Gautama Buddha, Shakyamuni Buddha. But if at the time the Buddha is alive, the Buddha's teaching is still alive, still passed down, another Buddha to arise, then it would be a confusing situation for people. This Buddha is teaching here, that Buddha is teaching there. And so it's said that one Buddha's teaching prevails at a particular period, and only when that Buddha's teaching decays, vanishes, disappears, can another Buddha appear. Because the special function of a Buddha is to discover the Dharma of enlightenment at a time when it's lost, when it's not known in the world. Okay, then the next is, it's said that it's impossible that for two wheel-turning monarchs to arise in the world at the same time. This is the wheel-turning monarch is the ideal ruler of Buddhist tradition. He's the one who unifies the world under the reign of goodness, virtue. And from a historical point of view, one would say that it's a legendary figure, since we don't have any examples in historical memory of a wheel-turning monarch. Okay, let us continue. First, I'll take this whole paragraph, then we'll open it up for discussion. And I'll have to, first I'll explain my point of view in this paragraph. Okay, he understands. And please, lock the doors, don't let anybody get out until I give my explanation. Okay, he understands it is impossible, it cannot happen, that a woman could be, this is what, we'll use simpler terminology, could be a perfectly enlightened Buddha. There is no such possibility, but it is possible that a man could be a perfectly enlightened Buddha. That's a possibility. Again, he understands it's impossible that a woman could become a wheel-turning monarch, that a woman could occupy the position of Sakya. Sakya is the king of the heavenly god, of the gods of the sense sphere heaven. It's impossible that a woman could occupy the position of Mara. Mara is the, in Buddhist tradition, he is called the evil one, the tempter, the one who tries to prevent others from attaining enlightenment. And it's impossible that a woman could occupy the position of Brahma. Brahma here probably is referring to Mahabrahma, who is the king of the deities in one of the higher celestial realms. Okay, but it's possible that a man could occupy the position of Sakya, Mara, and Brahma. Okay, so this is the passage, and now let me explain my understanding. First, qualifications and understanding. You know, if you look at this, one could take it, this is an example of ancient Indian misogyny, or putting women into lower positions. But first of all, one has to say that the Buddha held that women could achieve the state of enlightenment as liberated ones. So in that sense, the Buddha is not saying that women don't have the capacity for enlightenment. He said that women could achieve all four of the stages of enlightenment up to the stage of the fully liberated one, the one who's fully awakened, fully enlightened, an arahant. So in that sense, the Buddha's teaching is quite, call it revolutionary, or at least it's free from complete discrimination in that respect. And now, if we notice here, if we look at these positions, we see that there is the perfectly enlightened Buddha, the Sammasambuddha, the monarch, the universal monarch, the king of the lower gods, Mara, the chief of all of the evil ones, the chief of the forces of evil. Then there's Brahma, the chief of the higher gods. Okay, Brahma, what is it that unifies all of these people or these beings or positions? The unifying factor.
Because if they were all human positions, like a king.
That's true also. That isn't quite what I had in mind. Something else. Of course, they all have consciousness. Maybe I'm not stating the question clearly. What is it that unifies them and distinguishes them from others who might be in their same group? Exactly, that's exactly the word. Those are the authorities. And now we have to remember that the Buddha is teaching in ancient India. In ancient India, not only ancient India, but probably in India right up to the present, I have to say this with a little regret, but it's always the man who's in the position of authority. You know, it struck me, I don't know the Indian history in its totality, but I don't know of any eminent queens that have appeared in the history of India. We look at British history, you know, in Britain also, in traditional British society, the man would be a position of authority. But we have in, well, they call it the Elizabethan era, because who was the chief then? Queen Elizabeth I. She was the world, if anybody came close to being the world ruler, the world wheel-turning monarch, it was Queen Elizabeth, who had, you know, the territories, the Americas, all over the world. Well, maybe not quite at that time. But then later we have, in the 19th century, we named that era after her, the Victorian period, Queen Victoria. She also was like the world ruler at that time. And then even in China, always the man is the position of authority, but there have been some famous Chinese empresses. But Indian history, to my knowledge, I don't think there have been any eminent Indian queens who have ruled over the states of India. And so it's the authority that is being stressed here. And so this doesn't mean that a person who's a woman now, let us say, from the perspective of the text, it doesn't mean that a person who's a woman now can't become a Buddha in the future. But from the perspective of the text, as she's developing towards becoming, if she forms an aspiration to become a perfectly enlightened Buddha in the future, one who's going to discover and expound to the world the path to enlightenment, along the way, she'll have to take rebirth as a male. But this is some thought that I have. Again, my personal opinion. That something that... What is your name? Yeah.
Nelia
indicated when she said that they all are human, that the Buddhist texts are always depicting these situations, even in cosmic aeons, in the past and the future, modeling them after the situation of India in the time of the Buddha. And so it's said that whenever a Buddha arises, he's always coming from either the Kshatriya class or the Brahmin class. Like in other world systems, there are going to be the four classes of Indian society. And it strikes me a little bit strange. I've read something by some biologists who say that if somehow cosmic time were to be reversed and we were to go back to like the initial life forms that appeared on this earth even if conditions were to be just slightly different, the evolution of life would have taken completely different forms than it has now. So I just wonder how it's possible in other world systems for there to be beings depicted as human beings with necessarily of two sexes, male and female. Maybe there's possibilities in other world systems for there to be three sexes, so that for reproduction to take place, three of them have to get together rather than two. I think the reason why two sexes appeared was to vary the genetic combinations so that there could be greater diversity of life. But if two sexes have given rise to so much diversity, you can imagine what will happen if three are necessary, four are necessary. And maybe it's possible in other life forms for beings to be reborn as hermaphrodites capable of reproduction. You know, in the human world, there are people who are born as hermaphrodites, but I guess they're not capable of reproduction. But possibly in other world systems, there could be hermaphrodites that can reproduce with enough genetic variety to give great diversity. So when statements like this are made, you know, I just don't know how to interpret, or the way I interpret them is that everything is sort of expounded through the perspective of the situation in India in the Buddha's time, in which the male is the authority. And so in this passage, we see the male is the authority not only in the sphere of enlightenment with the Buddha, but also in the sphere of evil. You know, so you women can say, well, maybe we can't become a fully enlightened Buddha, but we don't become Mara. But in fact, you can become Mara also. That, you know, if your karmic actions lead you in that direction, then you can become Mara. It's just that from the perspective of the text, before you get to be Mara, you become a male. Does this make sense? No.
What if the next Buddha that will be born is not from India, but from a country like, say, America, where women may eventually become presidents? Then you may have a different perspective at that point, as compared to when this says women cannot become Buddhas.
Yeah, yeah. Again, I don't have some super normal ability to understand all of these passages and to make pronouncements. But all I could say again is that, you know, this is given from the perspective, the background of India in the Buddha's time. In fact, in the commentaries, I believe, it's always said that Buddhas always arise in Jambudvipa. Jambudvipa is the Indian subcontinent. But, you know, in other world systems, you know, this world is going to collapse at some time. Other world systems are going to arise. You know, assuming that they're going to develop to the point that they could sustain intelligent life, they're not going to have an India. So I saw a hand up. And I think... Oh, you have... Oh, okay, Ravi, then.
I think a lot of emphasis is given to the gender. I believe in the Chinese tradition and also some other traditions in nature.
I think you're not getting the... You're not speaking into the mic part itself.
In nature, as people grow old, they become gentler and normally kinder. Maybe the ladies also tend to... Maybe a little kinder sometimes. But how I see it is that very often when it comes to a higher level of mental and spiritual development, the gender is not important at all.
In fact, I agree with that too.
Now, if you look at the Kuan Yin in the Mahayana tradition, you can't say that it's a man or a lady. You know?
Actually,
it's not the body that's important.
Yeah.
It's a teaching and it's people there, and also in Buddhism, the order of nuns was the first one. Where the women were recognized was in Buddhism.
Yeah, that is so.
The whole world. I mean, that was the first time. That's what they say.
Yes, sir.
Established order was never in any other religion. There was no established order for ladies. You know. Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Andy, have it. Lotus Flower Sutra,
The chapter 12. And one of the bhikkhu also asked the same question because it is five possible and impossible.
Yeah.
And at the time, Manjushri Bodhisattva, he was come up to talk, and then one of the bhikkhu was asked him, usually what are you preaching? Manjushri Bodhisattva said that I'm preaching Lotus Flower Sutra. And he said, oh, this is a powerful sutra that the Buddha taught. Does anyone achieve enlightenment and attain the Buddhahood by this sutra? He said, yes. One of the girls, she was a dragon's daughter, and she studied this sutra and he attained the Buddhahood.
Yeah.
And right now, the Sariputra is a powerful bhikkhu, is the other bhikkhu. They said, that's impossible in these five, under these five condition, right? The woman never attained the Buddhahood. So now Manjushri was invited this dragon girl to show up.
Yeah.
She was show up and then she offered a pearl to the Buddha. And then it's so quick and fast, just like a second. And she asked Sariputra, does the Buddha accept this pearl enough? She said, yes, it's so quick. She said, you can see this. Just in a second, she turned to a Buddha and then go to preach in the Dhamma. And then now the Buddha proved that it's true. And then, but a lot of people in that time, they still think of these five conditions is real, right things.
Mm.
The Buddha, only the man, not the girl, not the woman. So I was very happy for this. Because then bring every woman, every one of us, think, oh, we still can come together, we still can attend the Buddha one day, right?
Yeah, so I think this is, it seems at this point it was somewhat controversial in certain periods,
In this chapter, the Sariputta still satisfied a different condition, that, the women never, and the men just reproved that, and that's great, Thank you.
Any other comment, question? Anybody want to give their point of view on this issue? Okay, so I think, please don't. Recognize that the text has to be understood against its historical period. Okay, the rest of the sutta deals with the working of karma, and just, I mean, it can be gone through rather quickly, because the time is running low. Okay, so the Buddha says it's impossible, it cannot happen that a agreeable result, some desirable result, some kind of happiness can arise from bodily misconduct, verbal misconduct, mental misconduct. In other words, bodily, verbal, mental misconduct, that is what we call bad karma, unwholesome action, whether body, speech, or thought. And so those types of misconduct, they create karma, and when that karma ripens, it's going to bring some type of unpleasant experience, something undesirable, unhappiness, suffering, pain, and so on. So that's paragraph 16, 17. It's impossible that an undesirable, disagreeable result could be produced from good conduct of body, speech, or mind. So in other words, when one creates, when one acts in a wholesome way by body, speech, or mind, one creates good karma or wholesome karma, and when that karma gets the opportunity to ripen, it will bring results that are agreeable, desirable, good fortune, good inner qualities, happiness, well-being. So those are, you call these paragraphs 16 and 17 are dealing with the direct results of karma in terms of its ripening. Paragraphs 18 and 19 are dealing with the rebirth potentials of karma. So he says it's impossible, it cannot happen that a person engaging in bodily, verbal, or mental misconduct, now this is the important phrase, could on that account, for that reason, on the dissolution of the body after death, be reborn in a happy destination, even in the heavenly world. So you see, it's what he's saying is that the misconduct of body, speech, or mind, when it produces its rebirth result, it will produce a rebirth result in the lower realms, one of the lower realms. But it's still possible that a person who engages in misconduct of body, speech, or mind could be reborn in a good destination, in a happy realm. But not because of that misconduct. Because we've all done, you know, a lot of good and bad deeds, and maybe we've done a number of bad deeds, but some very powerful, wholesome, good deeds. And so it could be the case that these powerful good deeds take on the role of producing rebirth. And so you can't look at the, say, when Bhikkhu Bodhi was a 12-year-old kid, he used to pick on little kids in the schoolyard, which was bad conduct. So how did he get reborn in the heavenly world? But I wasn't reborn in the heavenly world because I picked on little kids in the schoolyard when I was 12 years old. But no, I'm reborn in the heavenly world, and then one of the bigger deities beats me up. Then you ask, why is Deva Bodhi getting picked on by the big deities up there? Then somebody with a supervision looks into that and says, when he was 12 years old, he used to pick on this little kid in the schoolyard. So that's the result. And so the bad conduct of body, speech, or mind, when it takes on the role of generating rebirth, it brings rebirth in the lower realms, the bad destinations. Okay, then the converse of that in paragraph 19, it cannot happen that a person engaging in good bodily conduct, good verbal conduct, good mental conduct, could on that account, for that reason, after death, be reborn in one of the bad realms of rebirth. There is no such possibility. But it is possible that a person engaging in good bodily, verbal, mental conduct could on that account, after death, be reborn in a happy destination in the heavenly worlds. Okay, so this doesn't mean that a person who is doing good deeds of body, speech, and mind can't be reborn in one of the lower realms. But if he's reborn in one of the lower realms, this is because of some unwholesome karma that person has done. So it could be that maybe a person has committed murder, then he has a change of heart, and he does a lot of good deeds, maybe becomes a philanthropist or something like that. And so this person maybe then gets reborn in a lower world, maybe even in hell. Now, The reason why that person is reborn in hell, it's not because of the good deeds that they've done, but because of the unwholesome karma. So that unwholesome karma could, if it's really powerful, it could lead to the rebirth in hell. But the good karma is still there, and maybe it will bring some relief from the suffering in the lower rebirth. Like, to take an example, very concrete example, it's said that to be reborn as an animal, it's the result of an unwholesome karma. But there's a big difference between if one is an animal living out in the forest, always in danger of being captured by a bigger animal and eaten. You know, so those animals, they live in constant fear. It's always difficult to get food. And then one is reborn as a cat or a dog, which is adopted by a loving family, and you get a nice bed, no fear. Do they get 3 meals a day or two? And then that good karma also, it can, after the bad karma wears off, it can be, come to maturity and then produce good results or a good rebirth elsewhere. So it's very, very complicated, the workings of karma. But the principles are, you know, we could clearly determine the principles that unwholesome behavior of body, speech, or mind leads to undesirable results. Good or virtuous behavior of body, speech, or mind leads to desirable results. Okay, I'll just give like 5 minutes to questions now, then we'll come back after the lunch period, and then we could have further discussion. Adina.
I'm still troubled by why the Buddha even bothered to say that women could not... I mean, even though it was the times.
Yeah. And also...
Why did he even take the trouble to say that?
Yeah. Even, you know, one could also raise the question... I mean, I'm not saying that I necessarily agree with this. I haven't looked into it. But one could say that this could have been an
Interpolation
into the text, coming from a period when... It could have been like some resentment amongst the monks that the women are admitted into the monastic order, or maybe just to bolster the sense of superiority of men. I mean, that's always the possibility. Let us take in the back. Take the floating
pretty,
microphone.
I'm pretty loud.
Yeah, but it's for the recorder. Okay.
I think that our attachment to culture may be not appreciated until something like that is said.
Yeah.
But I wouldn't put too much stake in it, because we're not talking about a physical context where at that point in time, maybe in history, that was very much the driving force for that belief. We're talking about the enlightenment of the mind, where it's pretty obvious that man has no particular advantage over woman in any sense.
Looking at it again from the historical point of view, which I brought up, as far as the capacity for enlightenment goes, there's no text that says that a male has a superior capacity for enlightenment. A male has a superior capacity for enlightenment over a female. In fact, there's a little sutta. It comes in the Vikuni Sanyutta. These are the collected sayings with the nuns. There's a nun, she's meditating in seclusion. Then Mara comes to her and says, how could you make any pretext to be enlightened? You're a woman, not a man. And then the nun replies to Mara. She says, I know you, Mara. And then she says, she uses a verse, something like, when the mind is well concentrated and insight is flowing smoothly, then there's no obstruction to enlightenment. One who thinks, I am a man, I am a woman, that is the work of delusion. For one who is awakened, there's no sense, I am a man, no sense, I am a woman.
It kind of answers my question, because it was sounding to me, it was sounding to me as if the Pali Canon, chapter of the Pali Canon was arising out of conditions, because you kept saying, you know, this is a product of the times.
Yeah.
And, you know, just earlier we were learning about the deathless and the things that are unconditioned. But it then started to sound to me like, oh, well, this arises out of conditions. So it seemed...
Like this is historically conditioned by the period. And as I said, you know, within that period, the main point here is that the male is the figure of authority, and it's not intended to be saying, taking that prescriptively, that the man should be the figure of authority, but it's just taking that descriptively as the model of society. And then somehow it's, as I said, it's projecting that onto any other society that arises, as though that's the natural order of things. But in some societies, it's turned out to be quite different.
So this is arising out of conditions, that's
yeah.
what you're saying.
Yeah.
So this is not unconditioned.
That is so.
That what she just said may be part of the answer to what I want to raise. All of the attributing to the nature of society at the time doesn't do it for me, because it seems to me that the Buddha knows better than what the conditions of the time are.
One would expect that, but also I think he has to speak against the conditions of the time.
Yeah.
Okay, I think we'll have to break now for the lunch. It's one of the conditions of the time here that they serve lunch in the dining hall for the monastics at 11:30. Then we can come back, so you have a little time to chat in the lunch, in the dining hall, and to walk down. Say we come back 12:20. Last week, we started, what time do we start again last week? It was more like 12:30. Okay, 12:30 is better. So there could be a line there too. Okay, we'll make it 12:30. We'll have the discussion. 12:30 to 1. Okay, so thank you for your attention, and let us end with the sharing of the merit. Okay, so we share the merits with the devas, the Dharma-protecting deities, the fear spirits, and all beings, wishing them to be well and happy, free from from pain and suffering, and to protect the world, to protect the Dharma. Akasa ta chabuma ta deva naga mahitika punyantam anumoditva chiram rakantu sasanam. Akasa ta chabuma ta deva naga mahitika punyantam anumoditva chiram rakantu desanam. Akasa ta chabuma ta deva naga mahitika punyantam anumoditva chiram rakantu mamparam. Etavata cham hehi sampadam punya sampadam sabbe devanumodantu sabba sampati siddhya. Etavata cham hehi sampadam punya sampadam sabbe bhutanumodantu sabba sampati siddhya. Etavata cham hehi sampadam punya sampadam sabbe satanumodantu sabba sampati siddhya. Bhavagupadaya vichihetato etantare satakayupapanna rupiya rupicha asanya sanyino dukkha pamuchantu pusantu nibhutim. Okay, next week we'll have the class and we will go to sutta number 117. This is actually a very important, very interesting sutta called the Great 40. It gives a kind of detailed analysis of the factors of the Noble Eightfold Path. Okay, we end with the three half bows to the Buddha. And when we're doing half bows to the Buddha, also be aware that to the Buddha's left there's an image of Guanyin Bodhisattva.
Out of context.